Thank you so much for downloading this episode of So What Do You Really Do? The podcast where I, your host, Dead Air Dennis Maller, speaks to artists and entertainers about their day jobs. And on the program today, talking about his day job and talking about his chosen form of art form, comedy, is my good friend, Nico Lukoff. And I had to hesitate there because while we are friends, it is still virtual. Another pandemic friend who I still have not met in person yet. I've actually met a lot of my pandemic friends face-to-face. He is not on that list of it. Not yet, at least. There's hopefulness that Nico and I will get together and hang out and see each other and confirm that we do, in fact, have legs. In fact, we spend a portion of this show talking about the people who we ran into from the pandemic Zoom world of comedy, who we ran into in person over the past however long it's been. Because this one was actually right after recorded this episode in December of 2022, right when I just got back from Toronto doing the Far From Here Comedy Festival out there. So I was riding high on the my friends from the internet. And now I'm 2 months away from almost 2 months, February, March, no, more than two and a half months away from my trip in LA, where I got to see more of my pandemic friends in person and got to see one of my favorite comedy shows, podcast recordings, Hollywood Babylon with Kevin Smith and Ralph Garman. Even got to meet Ralph. So yeah, I wish I was still riding on that high. So I wish I was riding on the high of how much fun and enjoyable LA was for me. But here we are, working. In fact, I gotta slow down. I gotta talk softer. I have to preserve my voice. I'm making a career change, which we will talk about in an upcoming podcast episode. I think I've already teased it before in the other intros, where my new career is. We're working for Boston Duck Tours. I'm still right now as recording this in the, you know, practice tour set, still doing my training, and we'll be doing live tours with people soon. But y'all, my voice ain't holding up. It's so weird that I've never lost my voice ever. And now I'm feeling a little bit of strain. It's getting a little hard to talk after two or three. At most, I do two tours a day practicing 5 days a week. I've had the past 3 days off, and it's still, my voice is still a little weak and whatnot. And I'm very boisterous. I used to work in a nightclub talking, shouting all the time to have to get anything done, and never lost my voice. And I guess 10 years later, your voice needs a workout, or maybe my voice is just losing all its strength like the whole rest of my old body is. But there's going to be a lot more about the job coming up in future episodes of the podcast, so make sure if you're listening for the first time, please subscribe on whatever the network, interface, platform, app, however you listen to this podcast. Do me that favor. Go ahead and subscribe. And if you're coming back because you liked an episode previously, do me a favor. Leave a comment out there, please. It helps me and all my guests. All it would do is expose this podcast. The more people hear the podcast, the more they may potentially follow and like my guests, and that will make their careers that much better. So thank you for being here, and thank you for doing those in advance. But anyway, going back to Nico. Nico's job is he sells parts to beer suppliers. Like he sells parts that he talks about. It's very intricate stuff. It's equipment. It's technical, but it's still beer and other food safe grade products that he does. And it was very interesting how he got into that, because we knew during the pandemic that he turned around as being a salesman of some kind of beer parts. But I didn't know to the extent of it. So we got into it and just how he turned a hobby into a career. I mean, that's kind of what this whole podcast is about. Doing the things that we have to do during the day to support what we want to do at night. And if you can do what you do at night during the day to support it, then that's a win-win. You know what I mean? That's what this whole thing is about. That's what we're all trying to strive to do. Everyone who comes on this podcast, that's what we're all striving to try and do. So please enjoy my conversation with beer parts salesman and comedian, Nico Lukoff.
My daughter did run in one time during a Zoom show and just said, "Dad, would you be quiet, please?" Because I was being pretty loud and I was in a different area in the garage. And then I mute myself real quick. I'm like, "Shh, go outside." And then I come back. I'm like, "Did everybody just hear that?" I'm like, "They're just laughing." I'm like, "There's, I can't follow that."
Your kid comes in and is like, "Dad, shut up." Crunch.
That is exactly what happened.
Yeah, I'm lucky. All I have are a couple of roommates who know not to come down here and bother me here in my basement studio. And of course, I have my dog, nice, who is named Sister, who is the perfect podcast puppy because she just sits right outside of the door and just chills out. Sits in a little bed nice, and waits. Occasionally, she'll walk in and sit under the desk, which she'll shove me out of the way. But other than that, I'm lucky that I have no real issues recording where I have to turn, like, quickly mute myself and turn them like, "Shut up." Even during the pandemic, the one roommate that would come down here just comes down here to smoke his bong on the other side of the curtain, and he's moved out. So, you know, like, I have a podcast studio here, and then on the other side of this curtain is a literal drug den.
So, fair enough.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is where I sit and do my stuff. And then somebody gets smoked up over there.
They do their addiction.
And you sit there and do your thing and then go outside and you also get smoked up with your smoker, your barbecue.
Yep. I do.
Which, by the way, like, is, all right, we'll get into the job in a second, but I'm curious about the hobby because your food Instagram pics are so much more better than my, "Here's my vegetarian meat substitute thing I made that I swear tastes like the real thing, everyone." is barbecuing a required hobby if you're also into craft beers? Like, is it a hand-in-hand thing?
I started getting craft beer, the beard came, the gut came, and barbecue. Pretty much all at the same time.
It's like it's minimal requirements. Like, it's like the Boy Scouts. Like, you have to earn each rank of your craft beermanship.
I get like a brisket badge, and you know.
So, all right,
argue over ales be not lagers. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh yeah, correcting people on the difference between lagers and ales. Yes, that is definitely a craft beerman's merit badge to put on your. I gotta believe they're not gonna have sashes. They're gonna have kilt. You don't have sashes. You put your merit badges on a utila kilt.
Nice.
So yeah, let's talk about the job because
yeah,
it's an interesting one because, you know, I've worked in the food service industry, and your job is food service industry related, but it's supply based. Basically, you're a supplier of it, which is not a job you hear a lot of people have. Like, you might know a couple like beer distributors or wine distributors, but you work specifically at a brewery and I don't know this detail. So I'm going to make you tell me what it is. Cause I'm going to say,
no, that's
wrong.
Fine. So, well, you did just about everything. I'm just kidding. So I don't work at a brewery. So the company that I work for, and I'm in sales, that company is, we build machines called glycol chillers. They're process chillers. Basically, if there's any process somebody's using, which a lot of times is in the food beverage space, that needs to be cooled. We build a machine that sends cold fluid through their equipment. So, like, if you go to a brewery, it's the easiest way to explain. At a brewery, you've got the big, like, shiny stainless steel tanks. Well, on those tanks, there's actually, they call it a jacket inside. There's a little space inside that goes around them to have a coolant go through that to make sure that beer is the right temperature. When you're making the beer, you want to ferment it properly. The yeast has to be happy and all that stuff. So temperature control is really critical with that. So the company I work for builds the machines that cools that fluid, pumps it through their piping, goes and keeps the beer the right temperature. So
it's
a pretty critical part.
I know you work
for
a manufacturer of a product, but for some reason in my brain, that product is also manufactured in a brewery, which is not correct at all, and I know that. But every time I picture you going to work, you just walk into a giant warehouse, there's vats everywhere, instead of walking into, like, a factory or, you know, where most people work, an office. But in my head, it's like they manufacture, like, when you go to work, they're manufacturing both equipment for beer and beer, But it's, they're not selling the beer. It's for their own needs. That's what's in my head.
I'm sure some of the team does that. And a lot of places I do go is breweries. So like I work out of my home office. I did that before COVID. And then I would just, you know, get on site, go to breweries and, you know, meet with them, figure out what they need. Like Franz Bakery uses our chillers to cool their dough mixers. So a lot of different businesses use it. And it just happens to land me in really fun industry. So beer, wine, spirits, even cannabis extraction, dairies, dairy farms, cooling milk on farms. That was a big part of the business too.
Oh, so, yeah. I can imagine you need to keep dairy even before it's homogenized. You got to keep it at a certain temperature because, you know, you can't refrigerate these big, huge vats of milk. You got to keep them.
Yeah.
Like, you can't like bottle each little cow's milk and put it in a thing before you homogenize it.
No, so yeah, you want to make it cold right away. So cows are milked, goes through some systems, and then it goes through a heat exchanger that uses glycol, our cooling equipment, to cool that milk before it goes into a vat that goes on a truck to then be processed somewhere else. So on farm, where the cows actually are, dairy cooling is a good amount of the business that we do. And actually, our company started like 30 years ago. They built the first machine to do that. So it's pretty pretty first machine of its type to be able to do that cooling. So yeah, it's neat. Moving energy.
Wow. What so before your company, what were they doing? Were they just using ice or was it a different?
So that's a great question. I asked them, they had used some machines, but they had taken a lot of the pieces of equipment apart. And the people that founded our company actually just made like a packaged unit, as we call it, to do that cooling. And also there were ways where people would like bury milk and run cold water over it, like from a stream or something like that. And just not, you know, super consistent methods. And of course, as you know, food safety becomes more and more, you know, something that's paid attention to more and more, you know, that became more critical.
Okay. Well, you see, that's the thing is there's so much technology that goes into stuff that we don't even conceptually think about. Like we couldn't even fathom. Oh, yeah. That goes into the manufacturing. It's like, we know you go up to a cow, you milk a cow, you put it in a bucket, and then they separate the buckets into gallons, and they shows up at my grocery store. Or in my case, the gas station where I buy most of my groceries because I'm too lazy to walk to the actual grocery store.
Yeah, it has opened my eyes to a lot of that too. Like, I'll just be like, oh, there's Franz bread at the store that the mixer needed to be cold to do that. And I sell the machines that do that. So it's kind of interesting. I like it.
How many times are you walking through the grocery store with your kids and you go to point out and start telling an anecdote about a product? It's like, oh, one time I was at that dairy farm and the kids just go, Dad, we don't care about cooling food. Stop.
It has definitely happened once or twice. Where I'm like, oh, we're getting this food and this escape from this. And yeah.
Yeah, I have too many obscure anecdotes in my life to where like I know if I start telling the story, somebody's going to be like, cool, guess I had to have been there. Like, you should have.
It was really neat, damn it.
So how did you come to work for this company? Was it just something that popped up? Is there prior experience in this industry of equipment or general sales?
Yeah, so I started in the beer industry towards the end of 2008. I actually started a business at home selling hops to breweries. Actually, first of all, it's the home brewers because I was a home brewer. I was making beer, enjoying doing that. There's some shortages on certain hops. Basically, the spice in a beer. Like if you're making a sauce, you're not using a large proportion of it to make the whole thing, but it makes a big impact in flavors and aromas and that kind of thing. So so I started sourcing hops and selling to other home brewers and ended up just finding a niche there, or niche, I'm sure I'm saying that wrong. There's a need for, and I grew to start supplying breweries themselves. I started buying hops from farms and just kind of wheeling and dealing, figuring out what people needed. And then after a few years, it became a full-time business where I was able to, you know, support my family and some friends and family members who worked for me in selling hops. So I was in the beer industry for quite a while, ended up moving into equipment sales, and the hops business kind of went away. Basically, we made the mistake of trying to open a brewery and I trusted the wrong people, and a guy in his outfit scammed us and a bunch of other people. He's actually supposed to go to court pretty soon, and the stuff that he did to us is quote civil in a way that like we're not going to get anything back. you know, but he's since, you know, basically was taking deposits for equipment and saying, hey, I'm building this machine for you, or order this piece from this company over here for you, whatever it was. And he'd take that money and just scoot it over to another project and not actually do the things he was saying. And him and his wife were actually in on this whole scam. So they were just taking money from people who were like passionate about the business they were trying to open. And then that put us out of business eventually.
Oh, that sucks, dude.
That sucked.
Yes.
Yeah. That was sad story. Yeah.
Well, sorry I brought up the subject of we're going to have a happy, fun time.
Bump like, people
hey,
up.
Remember the time when you lost your business and all your money and your wealth and you got scammed by a dude? Anyway, sad violins. Tell me about the hop selling business. Were you farming hops, or were you like a middleman between farmers and people who needed hops?
Yeah, I was the middleman. I was sourcing it. So I would go to farms. Also, a lot of times what would happen is a brewery will contract to purchase a certain amount of a variety, and they don't always know how much hops they're going to actually use, but they're using that to forecast and tell the farms and distributors, you know, how much they're going to need at some point. Sometimes they end up having excess on their contract that they don't need, and they'd reach out to me because they knew that I could usually find a buyer for whatever they had excess of. So I would pay attention just who had what and just kind of wheel and deal and move and get people the varieties and things that they needed. It was pretty fun. It was fun being in the industry and being a part of an industry where people were just really passionate about what they were doing. And I was fortunate to turn it into something successful.
2008 was definitely before the big, huge craft, in my opinion. I think maybe I'm wrong on timelines, but 2008, when you're doing that, that's just prior before this big, huge craft beer boom and doing home brewing.
Yeah, it was going
2008,
up for sure.
Yeah. That was the beginning of the bubble, 2008, but also home brewing then was pretty difficult in 2008. I tried home brewing, I want to say prior to 2008, which by the way, up until a few years ago, I still had a 5-gallon vat of home brewed porter sitting at my parents' house for God near 20 years, almost like 15 years. And just sitting there. I never got to the bottling stage of it. So it just sat in this thing where I kept saying, I'm going to get it done. And just obviously never. And then eventually my wife or my sister's husband dumped it out in the yard for me. Because I was living here and I was like, all right, I guess I'm never coming back for that beer. But
yeah, and you were never going to do it. You were never going to dump that. So no. Let somebody did.
Like, I mean, you could, like, when I homebrewed prior to, let's hear, I'll say I was 23. That's probably about age I was. So that would have been 2004. And in the state of Maryland, there was two places that sold brewery kits. And by kits, I mean, you had all the stuff in one box, but they're like, they had a couple boxes of like prepackaged stuff, but they were still like, you still had to kind of figure out measurements and all that stuff. So there was two places in the entire state of Maryland that you could get the brewery kits from, and none were in Baltimore. Like the closest one was 45 minutes away. So I had to make that 45-minute drive, buy the kits, buy all the 5-gallon things that didn't work. They leaked. We lost a whole batch. We had to go back, get a new one, reseal it, do the whole thing together. And it was still prior to like just after we made that. That's when they started selling like at Walmart, like brew your own beer kit, where it's like a tiny little thing. And
like a gallon at a time.
Yeah, it's a gallon at a time. But it also is definitely, it doesn't have like this. It's more like the brewer's version of Easy Bake Oven. Where it's like everything
exactly,
is perfectly done and it still comes out fine. Like mine still had sediment at the bottom, like all that stuff that would settle at the bottom of the bottles. So 2008, what got you into home brewing that early in the interest of craft beers?
You know, so I started actually by making mead. We had some friends that were in the SCA. You might be familiar with them, bunch of nerds that go in the woods and camp and have their whole system of hierarchy stuff.
LARPing.
And we got, my wife and I got involved with it a bit. We had some friends that were like really, really into it. And then we just heard, you know, we're familiar with mead and been like, yeah, that sounds like a fun thing to do. So we made mead together and it was really fun and tasted great. And then I realized that beer is faster to make. And then I went, I could make alcohol quicker. That's kind of cool. And it was just fun. It was just a neat outlet of a way of, you know, creativity and thing to do. And
I don't want to let you in on a secret, but you can get alcohol really quick by going to a store and buying it. It's already made.
I've since learned this. I have no homebrewing equipment anymore. And whenever someone's like, oh, is that hard? I'm like, I will be happy to tell you how to homebrew and point you to a couple of websites of like great places for resources and things to buy. But I'm just not doing it. It's just so much cleaning and so much stuff. And it takes so much time. I'm not great at balancing the time with other stuff that I do. I'm just gonna go in and support those making the product.
Yeah, even like when we were doing it, you literally had to make a kegerator. No one sold one.
Oh yeah,
you had to like find on like it was almost like trying to find anarchist cookbooks. You have to find the products to make it. You got to go to Home Depot. You got to hope you can find a small refrigerator that's the right size that can hold a keg or even a party ball. You get, and then of course you have to distribute it to different containers, but you had to find that. You had to go to Home Depot. You had to search around on the dark web, like you're looking for the anarchist cookbook to find directions on how to make a kegerator, or just hope that if you drill a hole into this refrigerator that you bought at a yard sale, from some college
that everything
kid,
was going to be okay.
you're not going to pierce through some coolant and get sprayed in the face with it.
Yeah, that's right. I use one for just do fermentation where I got a chest freezer and I would put a thermostat to it so it would kick on to keep the temperature there at the right amount. Little did I know, some years later, I'd be in the business of helping others make sure they have the right temperature on their beer.
See, now, if we were making a movie of your life, that would be the foreshadowing moment. That's what...
There you go. Yep.
That would be the beginning of the second act break that foreshadows your turn halfway through the second act break. I've been reading a lot of scripts and doing a lot of screenplay writing classes recently. I need to change my mindset, but... All right. So yeah, basically all of this stems from just the hobbies of it. I'm going to say the state wrong because so many of them are just blurs into my mind.
I'm excited to see what you say.
Idaho.
Yeah.
Okay. You live in Idaho. There's so many of them that are just whatever. They're all the same to me.
I don't care at all if you call it the wrong thing. It doesn't really matter. I'm on a black screen and I could be wherever. But yeah. I live in Idaho. It's near Boise.
A lot of this industry, like obviously Idaho is well known for farming. So is a lot of the industry, the reason you were able to get into this because of living near where all this is happening? Or is it just a coincidence? Like I can imagine hops farmers that you're connecting with can't all be in the state of Idaho.
No. And people would ask me that when I was selling hops and like, I worked with several of the farms in Idaho, but most of the hops I got were from different places. Yakima, I imported some from Germany. I've imported and just got from wherever I can, get them from, for whatever I needed. But it was just convenient because after the hops business, I started, I still wanted to be in the industry and finding ways to serve that industry. I started importing stainless steel equipment. I found a supplier in China that did a good job of building those stainless steel tanks you'd see at a brewery. And then I was the middle person in that. And I worked with somebody to kind of help engineer some brew house equipment. And then I would import that. And then part of that though, I was saving people money on that portion. I want to make sure the mechanical part, the glycol chiller, that was super important. I knew like if that broke down, that'd be a big deal. I wanted domestic support for that. So I reached out to the company I now work for because they were known for having the best machinery for that. And then eventually with that company, my sales rep who I worked with and I was their customer ended up needing a salesperson in the Northwest region. I'm in Idaho and I was looking for like a real actual job and a stable paycheck. Yeah. And then that just kind of went from there. And that's how I got in there. So it is convenient that I'm here with that because a lot of our business is being in dairy farms. So I'm going a lot of, that's a lot of what we got in Idaho. So, it is convenient, but we do have salespeople all around the country that just focus on different things, kind of depending on where they are.
What I'm hearing from you is a very interesting thing that I can empathize with just in a different industry. Like you're a person who's like, you're sourcing equipment and necessities and needs of people in the farming, brewing, food industry where I was kind of a similar person in the like rock management thing in the early 2000s for my life, where I was like having to tell, consult bands on where to get stickers from, on what websites to hosting sites, on CD distributors and all that stuff, where like I had that same thing where it's like I'd be talking to a band, they're like, yeah, we're about to put out an album, we're just not sure where we're going to get pressed at. I was like, oh, well, what you need to do is you need to talk to this company here, and I'd be giving them that information. It was like, you know, they'd be like, hey, where do you get the stickers that your band, where does your band get their stickers from? I'm like, oh, well, we get them from Sticker Guy, so go to stickerguy.com. you got to make sure that your artwork is a certain size, this or that, because in the early 2000s no one knew how to Photoshop anything. Nobody knew what DPI was or that stuff for the most part. Like, you had to be a real computer geek in the late 90s, early 2000s to know that stuff. But I had to learn that stuff because there was no one else to learn it from. I was figuring it all out on my own and then passing that knowledge on to other people. So it's interesting to hear somebody else who is kind of also a self-starter facilitator of the things in their industry that literally started out as a hobby and that you turned it into a business.
I've always liked just finding what's not there and what I want to be there, and then figuring out how to fill that, and then helping other people do that too. Like, similar to how we met in, you know, on Facebook with Zoom stuff, like Displaced Comedians. Like, that's what that was. I wanted a thing that I didn't know that was there, and I wanted to put it there and make it happen, and then help other people kind of get to share and, you know, get value out of that too, and help share that knowledge of, you know, whatever it happens to be, whether it's, you know, making beer or where to go on a Zoom or, you know, whatever it is.
All right, and we'll get to Displaced Comedians, because, you know, I have a lot of thoughts on that. Which you've seen and heard many of my thoughts about it, whether you wanted to or not. But so when you, so let's talk about life pre-pandemic on this, because you were working from home. You said you were working from home. You basically had a home office through the company. How, from then to now, let's talk about, before we get about like the details of it, how much of your work has changed or been enhanced because of the pandemic?
Really, I just traveled a little less. I mean, that was the biggest thing. Breweries took a hit in certain areas, in certain styles, in certain business models. So there was a little less of working with breweries for a little while. Not black and white, but like a lot of breweries just stopped their projects of opening. You know, when it becomes not legal to have your business, people start not, you know, rethinking that sometimes. But other than that, I mean, it really, you know, just like a lot of businesses, a little more video calls. Like, we were already doing that though. So it really was just like, oh, I guess I'm just not traveling quite as much. And that's was really the biggest, you know, difference. It didn't really change a whole lot for that. And just my family was home more with me.
Okay. So it sounded like what you were doing was already technologically up to date with, like, I don't know, Google Drives or Dropboxes, or just digitally communicating with each other.
We were
stuff
already
like
doing
that. Okay. That's great. Yeah. That's
We did more. I mean, like, we just started doing it more often and more video calls than phone calls, kind of just internally, because there are other areas of the company that were a physical office. So they were used to seeing each other every day, but I wasn't. So it was like, oh, okay. We were already, like I said, pretty much doing it already.
Yeah. It's fun for me to try and see which companies or which industries were capable of doing the video home work from home lifestyle switch because of the pandemic, and which industries and companies were not. Because I knew there are plenty of people I knew that worked from home prior to the pandemic, but the way they worked from home was vastly different than the way they worked from home after the pandemic. Some people and some like you are just like, no real big change. We were already doing the things that we were doing. We were already up to date to it. Like, you know, the day job I had just picked up prior to the pandemic is I started doing video conferencing for a law firm. So literally every day, me and a team of six guys would set up and execute anywhere between 15 and 80 video conferences a day, hybrid meetings a day. And none of them were on Zoom. They're all on a proprietary, WebEx was our main thing. We use a couple other things here and there. We use some proprietary stuff, but honestly, that job prepared me for the pandemic better than any other job I could have had. Like, one of my jobs in radio was remote broadcast engineer. So anytime we wanted to do the radio show from outside of the building, and I would do almost 300 events a year, you know, somewhere between like 150 and 300 events a year, something like that. Of anytime a radio show wanted to do their show from outside of the building, I would go set up and do all that tech. And I'm well familiar with that, but that's all audio. Now we're switching into video. I'm jumping into a video job. The only reason I knew as much about Zoom as I did is because I spent 2 weeks in the office by myself when they sent everybody else to work from home, learning Zoom, knowing that they were going to switch to this because the employees kept asking for it. Like, we had much better technology, but everybody wanted virtual backgrounds. I want to look, everyone. I'm in France. See, Eiffel Tower.
I remember caring about that. I remember giving a shit about having a virtual background.
Right? Without
a green
screen.
Anymore, but look, I used to.
Look, yeah. Guys, you're all at home. I'm at the beach. See, it's the beach. I'm at the beach. Ugh. Honestly, and so what they did is they finally gave them Zoom access, and they said the AV department, which we were a third party company, like the AV team, has nothing to do with this. If you have any problems, you need to call IT, and we're giving you all access and control to yourselves. And I would still get calls, nonstop calls and emails from people like, I need you to help me with this Zoom thing. And I'm like, I'm not allowed to. I was expecting to actually have to train and teach 300 people how to run Zoom. And luckily I didn't. I would field calls. Nice. And of course, all the calls were the same thing. They would call and email about something else. Like, oh, I'm having trouble logging in. I was like, okay, cool. And then you talk to them and they're like, awesome, how do I do a virtual background? It's like, no, shut up. No, nope. That's what you want. This is not a toy. This is not a play. You're here to go over your legal briefs or whatever it is that you lawyer people do. Right. You're not here to like France, space. I'm in space. Look at me. Ugh. I hate it. The amount of Zoom calls that I would get on with somebody and be like, space. Look at me. It's my cat, guys. Look at a picture of my cat. Look how big my cat is. Like, ugh. I hate all of you people. But so it's nice to see that your company was already well ahead of doing all that.
Yeah,
because you're
especially
industry,
my
like,
role.
Yeah, because like you're dealing with farmers, you're dealing with, you know, people who work with their hands, people who build things, who, no offense to anybody in that industry, the stereotype is they are Luddites. During the pandemic, was there at least one farmer where you like, he's zooming from his iPhone for the first time and you're like, all right, Jebediah, you need to turn the camera around so I can see you. Was there any of you having to play unintentional tech support?
We've definitely helped on some meetings, but honestly, most of the farm stuff, we just get on site. But we did definitely have some video calls with people that, you know, had to help a little bit. But most of the farms, and it was interesting too, just seeing who did different stuff, like who was wearing a mask and where, because dude, you go to a dairy farm, no, they're not going to stop. No one's going to stop having meetings. They're not going to stop. You know, they need to make sure these machines run all the time. And that's one of the reasons we stayed open is, you know, because all the businesses that were considered essential, where we cool a good portion, I think it was half or a little bit more than half of the milk on dairy farms in the country, which is actually kind of cool to learn when that was happening. But yeah, we're still getting out there and getting into it. But yeah, there were definitely some times on video calls that were kind of tricky and kind of funny to have to explain to people.
So that's an interesting, you're somebody who was in, I'm assuming, both sides of the cautiousness of COVID.
Yeah.
Where you're with comedians, you know, we are all for the most part, like at least, especially the people who are doing Zoom comedy were very conscious and aware of COVID. The people who thought COVID was a myth usually either quit comedy or is just waiting around. Yeah, they refuse to do Zoom comedy. The ones who are like, I'm not going to wear a mask in public, and I'm not going to get on Zoom to tell jokes to nobody on mute. Like, those are the same. Like, those are two very different polarizing people. But I got to imagine the industry of people in the Midwest, the Pacific Northwest, that territory where you're at, are people that are like, I don't have time to slow down, put on a mask, and worry about this COVID thing. I still have to do my job. So where was it uncomfortable for you? Like when you still had to show up to places and you're wearing a mask and you know, they're giving you that look like, you know, like, oh,
come on. You know, I try to read the room a little bit, because like I got my vaccination stuff. I wash my hands. I wear a mask in places that say you need to wear a mask. But if other people weren't, I generally just kind of didn't make out with them as much. Like that was, I mean, but I'd go into an office. It was kind of weird sometimes. I would go in an office and I wouldn't know right away. Like I figured it out pretty quick, but initially I didn't. I'd open the door and like, I'm going in with the mask. No one's wearing a mask. And they're like, oh, we've all got COVID already. It's okay. You don't have to wear that. Like, oh my gosh. And there was a couple times where I still wore it, but then I got to the point where I was like, I think I had it too originally when it was early and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I'm not aware of having gotten it since, but I was worried because like I was actually when that week when kind of COVID just, you know, really hit where they're like, hey, don't go anywhere. I was actually in Seattle for a trade show that was canceled because of COVID, but I still made the flight to go visit some customers and do some things there. And just a weird week where everything, and it was in Seattle where like, you know, a lot of at the time where we thought a lot of the stuff had started, you know, so it was weird going out. And then, you know, at that time we weren't wearing masks. We didn't really know what was happening. And then after an open mic, going to a bar that usually was like a big hangout and there's just nobody out. And then we're like, oh shit, this is weird. This is actually happening. So all that from that till now. Yeah. It also just to go to different areas. Like I would, when I drive somewhere, depending on if I was in somewhere that was a little more conservative kind of area or a little more known as blue or liberal or whatever, that obviously was someone that, you know, wearing a mask or not. So I would, you know, 1 hour I'd be somewhere where no one was wearing a mask. And then a couple hours later where everybody was, it was just,
see, that's where interesting like, to navigate. Me, I have no, like, you know, I'm for the most part during most of COVID pro mask, but I don't know. I had a very complicated relationships with masks in that I agree. Masks are preventative. They're not protective. And so that's where I came from. You know, that was the stance that I was like, look, if everyone's wearing a mask, then the person who has COVID is less likely to give it to us. But if I put on a mask, it's not going to protect me from other people not wearing the mask, you know?
Yeah.
And also most of the masks, like when we were still unsure if it was airborne, and I use it, finger quotes, not to be sarcastic. I use it to be very specific to the word airborne, because that is a very specific detail of how things are passed on. And wearing a bandana on your face wasn't going to protect you from an airborne virus. Like before we knew it was airborne or before we knew it was not airborne and we were concerned with it, you know, a gator sleeve wasn't going to protect you. You know, like the N95s, yes, which nobody was wearing, you know, full air respirator, even an N95 is not going to protect it, is not as good at protecting you as a respirator, like a full sealed respirator and stuff like that. So there was still in my mind, a lot of this is performance. There's a lot of like self-soothing things, but you know, even still to this day, like the amount of people that wear a mask under their nose is like, who are you fooling? Why are you doing this? Like, stop it. Like either wear it right or don't wear it at all.
Yeah.
But I during the pandemic didn't have much of a fear of getting it and not surviving. Like I have heart disease, and so technically I'm immunocompromised. I think I'm just what it is. I'm too depressed and suicidal that I was like, if I get it and die from it, cool. I just don't have to write a note. I think that was my thinking. But I was always more worried of passing it on. Luckily, I don't have anybody around me that's, you know, the problem. You had a family and kids. Was that a huge concern?
Yeah, so that was my big concern. That was a bit of a concern. There were some moments in my job where I had to talk with my wife and I had some talks of like, okay, I'm being asked to go to like, I went to a trade show kind of in the middle of it, but it was one where they had limited people there and everyone was supposed to wear masks and most people did. But it was like, okay, how do we do this? And it's, you know, similar like to myself, like I wasn't super worried about myself, you know, me getting it and dying from it, but I don't want to spread it or to anybody. Cause I'm, if I'm flying places, especially, but also, you know, don't want to bring it back to my family. You know, I got, you know, young kids and I don't want my wife or my kids to get sick from it or get it to anybody else. I had this thing that I'm like, man, it would just be, you know, asshole traveling salesman brings COVID, you know, that would be the thing. Like, wouldn't it be just like, he just had to go out and freaking try to sell something, and then he goes gets people sick. I was just like, this
you had
suck.
To go out and sell your beer cooling equipment. Yeah. No, you can't just let people buy koozies and let them get away with using koozies to keep the beers cold. No, Nico.
Most customers got it, but some didn't. They were like, hey, can you come here? I'm like, do you know what's happening? Like, what? Like, you, and then I still did make some of those trips when they were like, we're pressing about it. And then, you know, comedy spots were different just because, you know, for a good while, I wasn't going out and doing comedy when I was traveling for work. But then, you know, it's like, were you wearing masks and what places are requiring what? And now I just kind of go do whatever.
Yeah. I mean, if there's anyone who zoomed from more hotel rooms during the pandemic, it's you. Like, I don't know anyone else.
A few times. Yeah.
Well, So when into working in this traveling industry of food fabrication equipment, did you start doing comedy?
So I had this job for about 7 months or so. And I think like a lot of people who start doing comedy for the couple years before it, I was thinking about it. I was writing stuff. I was making little recordings and sending it to my friends. So I have no idea how they still talk to me. They were so bad. I just knew that there was an open mics. I just knew that there was like 3 or 4 minutes. That's all so I thought it was like 3 or 4 minutes to get to a punchline. And I love telling people that.
That is the shaggiest of shaggy dog jokes. If you're doing 3 to 4 minutes and then,
it was so bad. I'm like, here's a story of this stuff. I'm like, they're like, well, there's got to be a payoff. I'm like, well, here's the payoff. I didn't get, they were saying like, I'm telling you that because there isn't. Because stuff just goes over my head, that kind of stuff. And then luckily, eventually, I figured out at least what you're supposed to do. But then, and I was one trip going to Portland. I just thought, you know what, if on this trip, I had a couple stories I'd been thinking of that I wanted to do. And on this trip, if I get an opportunity to go do comedy, I'm going to do it. And then I was having lunch and I was wrapping up the day and I was kind of doing a late lunch, early dinner deal. And I went, you know what? If I find somewhere tonight to do it, I'm going to go out and do it. And I just Googled, you know, my phone, just, you know, comedy open mic Portland. And there's one at a place called Helium. I'm like, I don't even know what a Helium is, but I guess that's a.
It's a gas they fill with balloons.
And then I went, I'm going to do that. And then, and that's the first night that I went out and did comedy. And it's neat because I really like combining my job with it because I think there's a lot of, especially in sales, you know, you're connecting, you're just being with people. And some people would take, you know, their customers out bowling or out to do whatever event, you know, they want to do. And I, since this, have taken them out to comedy shows and open mics and different things like that. So my first night, I actually invited and took out distributors of our equipment they'd sell other brewing equipment like I had prior.
No.
So I was
going to ask you if your first open mic was out of town in front of only strangers so you didn't have to live or remember that regret. No, you took clients
sort of
to an open mic, your first open mic? Oh, no.
I mean, It was a different town, so it took me a while to get the guts up to actually do comedy in Idaho. But yeah, my first open mic, and I had just met these guys. We had emailed and done, you know, phone calls and whatever prior, but we had just met that day, and you know, so I'm trying to, you know, support them in selling our equipment, and these guys Mike and Don, and I just text. We had made plans loosely to have dinner that night, like we're gonna do something. And I kind of knew what I was going to do, but I didn't want to tell them right away. So then I texted them.
Oh, no, you surprised open mic them? Oh,
yeah.
God, this is the horror story of my nightmares. Oh,
so I text them. I'm like, hey, guys, I know we're going to meet up for dinner. If you still want to do that, this is where I'm going to be. If you want to go get dinner, there's doing this thing at Helium Comedy Club. There's an open mic if you want to go check it out. You know, we'll buy you dinner. So part of my job, I get to, you know, kind of wine and dine a little bit, you know, and take people out. Like sometimes take people, you know, fancier places, but you know, it's just having a good time. And they're like, yeah, that sounds great. You know, we'll go to Helium. And I actually bought them. So one of them actually has a ticket that says Nico Lukoff Helium $5 on it, like a ticket. It was a ticket, just me buying a ticket I didn't know that they were going to be able to get in for free by being with me. So I bought a ticket for them originally online already and got that to them. Nico Lukov is just being my name as the person buying the ticket, not as actually being on the bill, but that was fun. So they show up and I'm like, yeah, you know, they get there and I'm like pacing outside and I already signed up. So I already found out that I got on the list. So I just go like, here's my company card, go sit down, get some food, get some drinks. I'm going to be pacing out here for a while. You guys wait inside because you're going to see me try stand-up comedy for the first time.
Oh God, dude, you don't understand how like much this story is making me cringe and curl up. Like,
I love watching you freak out. This is so good.
It's a nightmare story. This is the worst story.
So
please continue.
It gets worse.
Trust me. I don't think it's going to get better. Like, and I got a standing ovation and they signed me to a Comedy Central. Like, I know how the story's going to end. That's why I'm so uncomfortable.
So it was, so as you know, most open mics aren't like a packed comedy club with a hot audience. Most of them just a bar. We're all just talking to each other, happen to be taking turns holding a microphone. But this was a packed room known for having a really good audience. And I didn't really understand that at the time, like what the differences were. Like the first open mic I went to, I was in had a green room at a nice club. Like the next place I went, I'm like, hey, where's the green room? They're like, you're not going to the green room. Are you crazy? The next one
I
went to,
there's
at a club.
A room.
And it was at a club. So the next one I did, one of the next ones I did at Spokane Comedy Club, it was funny because I was asking about that. They're like, there is a green room here, but you're not seeing that for at least a while, if ever. So they go sit down and I'm pacing back and forth. And they had told me I had 3 minutes. For some reason, I thought I had five and I freaked out thinking like, oh, I only have like the stories. You know, when you start, like, you're like, oh, this story I have to get to the end and it only works if I have 5 minutes. Yep. And I'm like, I did not have 5 minutes. So I go in and the host kicks it off. And it's funny because I had introduced myself to him and his name's Shane Brennan. He recently just won Portland's Funniest Comedian. Recently to now, not back then. I was talking to him and he's like, oh, is this your first time here? I'm like, yeah, this is my first time doing comedy. He's like, okay. And then when he does his set, and I'm like, he could have been doing this without me in the green room, but I just felt like he was kind of cueing me up a little bit. He goes, by the way, you know, to the audience, if you you made people at work laugh around the water cooler, you watched the Netflix special and think you could do it, and you try this for the first time, maybe don't do it at a packed comedy club in front of hundreds of people. And I'm in the back just going like, thank you so much for doing it. Like, it was a perfect setup. So then,
is he talking about me?
So when I went out, it is funny too, because I was like, when do I go out? And the next comic's like, when they call your name, that's when you walk out. I'm like, I don't even know like the mechanics of any of this. So then another comic went up and then they introduced me and I went up and I got to play with that a little bit and be like, well, I think he was talking about me. So he just described me at least. Let's see how this goes. And I didn't die. Like I had obviously could have been better, but you know, that first time also people love on you a little more. They know it's your first time. You have a little bit different energy, but it went fine.
They're a little more sympathetic.
I felt amazing. Yeah. And it's all connecting and just, I feel like you got a few minutes to make them fall in love with you. Like that's the whole thing. We're doing this together. And, you know, they know it's your first time. You get a little bit more love on that side, but which is nice. I didn't do horrible, didn't do great, whatever. Talked, didn't die. But when I got off that stage, man, the electricity through my veins, I felt incredible. And I was 100% sober. I didn't want to screw up any more than I was going to anyway. And two, I just want to feel that disparity for that fear. And then the thing actually happening, I want to feel that juice. And I did. And it felt incredible. And I sat down with the guys that I had just met and just drank and enjoyed the rest of the show. And then at the end, the last comic, Adam Posse, who had just won Portland's Funniest Person, so he was closing out the mic with a little longer set. He talks about living in Samoa. And part of my set, I talk about getting sent away as a kid for getting in some trouble. And I got a tattoo. I had a tattoo on my leg. So I lived in Samoa for a little while. When I came back, I took some artwork from there and I got a tattoo on my leg. About it when I got home. And then I saw Adam, who's half Samoan, and he talks about that in his set. he's, you know, at the bar in the back, and I introduced myself, and he said some nice things and gave me some feedback on my set. It was cool. I didn't know he had seen it. And I said, hey, you know, I lived in Samoa actually for a year. The place I mentioned on stage was Samoa. I didn't specifically say that because I hadn't figured out jokes for it yet. But I'm like, that's really cool that you're Samoan here. And I showed him my tattoo. And then he's like, dude, he's like, I've never been to Samoa. So you're actually more Samoan than me. And it's just a nice dude. He's fun. And then he ends up, so, you know, he leaves the guys I'm hanging out with. He goes to meet, talk to some other people. He's like, hey, you guys, I'll see you later. I'm going to go talk to some people. So I thought I'd never see him again. And that was fine. But then he came back and he goes, hey, do you want to go to another mic? I went, oh, that's a thing that what? That I had no idea this was even an option. And we go to a more of a typical open mic where it's a bar and it's just the comics and a couple of drunk people, you know, at the bar and the bartender. So I ended up going up there, and then he invited me to go hang out at their, it's called the Clinton House. It's a party house, comics renting the house in Portland. So I hung out with all the comics I'd seen that night before, a lot of them, you know, their boyfriends and girlfriends and bartenders, and hung out till like 3 a.m. drinking White Claws on the porch. And that was my first night into comedy.
Oh, wow. See, here's the thing that I learned about you I noticed about you, because by the time the pandemic hit, like, you were doing, if I remember correctly, comedy a little bit off and on, and then the pandemic hit. You were only in, what, maybe a year in when the pandemic hit?
Less, yeah. 7 months from my first set to that. So I feel like it struck at the right time for me. So I had just gotten a taste, and I was naive enough. Like, it was the right combination of things, I think, to be able to, I won't say take advantage of a negative way, but utilize the situation.
Yeah. Well, it's one thing that I noticed about you that is really hard for a lot of people when they start comedy is that you have charm. Like, you just have a natural charm ability. You're a likable guy. You're jolly. You're happy. It's easy to be on your side of things, you know, because you're likable. And that goes so far in comedy than anything else. And it's also a thing you can't teach somebody. Either you are just likable or you're not. I've had to learn to be more likable. Yeah. Well, no, I've had to learn to be more likable because there's traits about me that are very unlikable. Like, I'm very boisterous. I might be 5'6", but I'm a big personality. I take up a lot of space on stage. I'm very aggressive looking. The bald head, the beard. I'm going to just generally naturally aggressive person, even if I'm not trying to be. I just come off that way. And I've had to learn to use that to my advantage, or how to underplay that to get people on my side before I can start doing that. And if I come out like on stage too hot, too fast, too big, I'm going to turn a crowd off real fast. You know, so those are things that I've had to learn to balance. Even though I'm very gregarious and I can be very likable, it takes sometimes, it takes a certain mindset, or it takes a certain amount of, you know, me being palatable for me to be the likable that I want you to like me at. And we know how many comedians have no personality, no charm, no likability. They just come out there and they tell jokes and you're like, all right, well, no wonder you can't sell this dark humor joke of suicide. It's because you're just generally unlikable. Like, if you get them to like you, they'll be on board with your dark jokes. Like, you know, so many, like, you're a sociable person. You can go out and you can talk to people, you know?
Yeah.
How many comedians do we know just can't talk to each other, let alone talk to just civilians outside of being on stage?
And that is one thing that I appreciate that. And I do feel like I likable, whatever, but like almost more I want to touch on there is I know so many comics who, and as you know, everybody does that, like, they're on stage, they're extroverted or whatever, but off stage they're not.
Mm-hmm.
And I am in as extroverted as a person can be. I just always have been. I have stuff that I feel is important to say. I want to say it. I'm going to find out a way to say it to people. And I just like going out. So like when I was at, you know, the first, you know, while when I was having this job where I could hang out in a hotel room and watch Netflix and just chill at night, do a little bit of work, but just like this is pretty cool. And I had to go find a thing that was stressful and difficult to go out and do. Like, one of the things that a lot of people find to be one of the hardest things to do, just because I wanted to have that outlet. And that's what that's given me. And that combination of that and balance of bringing that together and bringing that experience and I don't say schmoozing. It's not a negative way or non integrous way. I don't think integrous is the right word, but legit ways is taking basically what I'm saying, taking customers out and doing stuff and connecting that way. And it's a legit way to do that. And I really, really enjoy it.
Yeah. And there's a good way and a right way to like charm people. And there's also a sleazy way of doing it. And you don't ever, you never stroke me as the sleazy way. You know, I've worked with way too many people that are like, hey, they're cool. And they're like, they're, what's the name of the guy from Die Hard that tries, that ends up telling Hans Gruber that,
that piece of shit.
Yeah, that guy. Like,
we all know you're talking about.
Is his name. I've met too many Ellis's in my life where they're like, yeah, I'm cool and likable whenever he likes me, but I'm really sleazy about it. Like, there's too many sleazy salespeople out there
There is.
Yeah. Like, even if they're not salespeople, just like, boy, do I know a lot of sleazeball comics, too. I'm not going to mention names on that because, I could mention names. Not like any of them listen to the show. They're usually the ones that are telling people behind my back how much my show. Honestly, I have gotten comments from people about this show that like screen grabs of secret text conversations about me that claimed I edited celebrity, some of the bigger name celebrities I've had on there. They have claimed that I've edited other interviews and just inserted myself into it. I'm like, bro, I got skills, but I don't have that kind of time or patience. Like, yes, I can do that, but I'm not going to. That is way too, it's literally easier to just get them for an interview than it is
I believe either that was Lewis Black I was listening to this morning when I was listening to some episodes. I believe you that it was those guys that you were doing.
Yeah. So yeah, like speaking of comics who are sleazeballs, those are the ones. They're like, well, he's just he took Jessica Kirsten's words from her podcast and then he just inserted himself into it. I'm like, no, why would I do that?
That sounds like a lot of work.
That sounds like more work than it was when her publicist emailed me. But yeah, so, all right. So you were figuring comedy out basically. There's a lot of people like who can start comedy off that have stage presence, that have charm, that have likability, but they don't have jokes. And some of them for the rest of their lives will rely on their charm and likability and never learn to write because they don't have that self-awareness. You definitely did have at least self-awareness for a while where you're like, hey guys, can I make this better? Oh God, how do I? Cause
at
least I've seen you try. Constantly. Like we've talked about, you know, in our off open mic Zoom hangouts or writing sessions or whatever, you know, I can hand it to you. Like somebody gives you a suggestion, you at least use it. The amount of people that I see that they have a joke that doesn't work, someone gives them something that works and then they still don't use it because of pride, ignorance, hubris, whatever it is that
I just want to get better. However that comes. And if I get feedback, I love getting, one of the things I like about Zoom and kind of miss about Zoom, is it's so easy to give each other feedback. So like at live stuff, you know, friends will be, but it's still awkward. It's a little more awkward because you're all hanging out afterwards and you still, you know, still share tags and stuff, but it's so easy during a Zoom to be like, oh, you know, Dennis, he said this thing. And then I'll just type in, you know, a notepad or whatever, OneNote real quick. And then later, if we don't already have the relationship or not, I'm like, hey, I thought of some stuff during your set. Mind if I send it to you? And most people are like, yeah. And then, you know, like that sounds good. And then I'll send something and vice versa. And I do kind of miss that a little bit, but yeah, I just want to get better. And if someone gives me a line that I think is horrible, I might not use it, but at least I want to soak it in. It's not going to hurt anything to hear it.
Yeah, there's definitely,
I get a lot of good lines like that.
There's definitely more comfortability doing suggestions on Zoom than there are in person. I don't know what it is. Like, it also helps. It's like, while somebody says something, you can just put it in the chat and boom, it's there. You know,
it's so easy.
Whereas like when you're on stage live in person, you can't just be like, maybe you should say this. You can't do that immediate in the middle of the thing. You can kind of throw it in the chat and then there's a record of it. But yeah, there is like, even to the point like now when, you know, I've been doing comedy 12 years, 14 years, 9 years. I have no fucking idea anymore. Somewhere around somewhere over a decade. And I rarely ever give unsolicited jokes because I just know how people are about it. What I'll do is if you know, I'd use more of, oh, what I wrote for you, I'll see how I can create a new joke off of that. Unless we're specifically talking about suggestions or writing sessions and stuff like that. But even in all these years that I've done it, all these writer groups I've done, it's still kind of uncomfortable to look somebody in the face and go, hey, maybe you should say this. but I always try to go analytical on, like, you know, like I had a really good, I was with a really good group of people as a writer's group that we met weekly, and we focused on structure more than anything else. Like that's where we realized, you know, that was what was beneficial in our group, was talking about why this doesn't work and why this might work, or this is why it's working. Like, we'll give compliments on why it's working and try to figure out, try to say why it is. That way we can understand when we want to change it, or when we apply it, that methodology to another joke, we understand that.
And think of that, to do that more frequently too. Cause like, oh, this is why it works. Maybe my next thing I'll think up.
Because most of the time writers groups are just, this is their suggestion is, this is how I would have told the joke. And it's like, that's your perspective. That's your point of view. That doesn't necessarily work for me as a person, but also your written version of the joke structurally is just the same format of the joke, just different words. So, you know, that's why I never found a lot of helpfulness in a lot of these, because most of them just boil down to, here's how I would add a dick joke in there, you know? You know, like, you there's always somebody in that writer's group that just has to dirty everything up. Like, that's all they know how to do, is turn everything into a dirty sex joke. Like, what you should do is talk about your penis. Yeah, right? And it's like, all right, Jason.
In the last year or so, the most, I've only done a few Zooms in the last year or so. I just, like, very specific ones. Like, if it's like, this is a show I want to do, this is a friend's putting this on, I really want to just have fun on it. But when I've run my own, is I've just been, hey, let's get, this has been my favorite way to do, hey, let's get four or five comics, and we're just going to do sets, and we're going to talk after each set. I did this a few times. I really enjoyed it. We're going to talk after each set just about the set and what we suggest to make it better. And now we're not ripping on each other for anything. It's like, this is what I think could be better, or maybe this is a thing to do. And sometimes it was, you know, a minute of feedback. Sometimes it was 15 minutes of feedback on somebody's set, just because, you know, and I'd make sure to have some comics in there who, like, have been doing it for a long time. Like, I'd have, like, Winston Hodges, you know, I would try to get in there, someone who I really, you know, trusted in, and has, you know, been doing this for a long time and does a really good job of it. And a mix of people who are a little newer, and I'm, you know, I'm much newer. And then just, you know, helping each other. And I really like that. And that's one of the big things I like. And as you know, that's kind of been my vibe that I've been trying to push on that group, is just help each other and make it kind of about comedy, probably. Like, that's like my main core of it. I know we're going to go back to it, but I just want to slip
that in. Let's, like, bring up displaced comedians, because I do want to say, I gave up trying to be helpful after the second time I was attacked for telling comedians they should get paid for their work, and was attacked for it.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Twice somebody was like, hi, I want you all to work for free and do this and that. I'm like, hey guys, everyone, you're great, you're wonderful, you deserve to be paid, don't accept for being free. And then the comment section reply was like, we don't deserve to be paid, shut up, Dennis, stop ruining this for us. I'm like, whatever. All right.
And there's a and I hear that. It's like when I see a comic who's like a legit comic who I've, you know, who I just know has a lot of value, like, leave the group or something, I'm like, ah, damn it, I get it why you left, but I'm sorry that we lost you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm also, you know, like I said, even in the written form, I'm abrasive. Even, like, in physical, face-to-face, I just come off abrasive, and in the written form as well. So I don't blame people for their, like, hey, is this bald-headed, scary, Breitbart, Breitbart stock photo Breitbart looking guy, is he, trying to, like, attack us? And it's like, no, I'm trying to help you, I'm trying to better yourself. Like, that's,
you dumb motherfucker.
Even my, when I read my comments back to myself, they all sound like they're in this voice, and I'm like, I don't know.
That's so funny. I think
I don't know why. I don't know.
Think about
why.
You reading your own comments and being like, wow, that was mean. Like, that's really funny to me to think that. No, and it's obvious. I know your heart's in a spot. And we're all just a bunch of different perspectives of people, too. So, like, I know something I've learned about running this thing, if you want to call it running, whatever, being the person who technically is the person in charge. I have a hard time even saying that.
The man who created the Displaced Comedians Facebook group.
Yeah. I did that for sure. is seeing that there's so many perspectives of different people. And I could tell when I could generally tell fairly well, I think, if someone's heart's in the right place, but they're just saying it in a way that's not going to get the reaction. And it's, and that goes back to communication and connection. Just what we all do. Just like one of the most important things in life. I feel like, so trying to shift the conversation in a way when I, like, I get what someone's trying to say and they're saying it in one way, but let's try to help people understand this is where they're coming from, da da da.
Well, that's kind of where a lot of my energy's gone. In comedy, you know, let's just be broad about it. There is a general sense of ego that you need to have just to do comedy. You need to have a little bit of an ego to be able to bomb on stage and get up and go do it again. There has to be something that drives you, and part of that drive is ego. You have to think, you know, that either that it's not your fault or that you're going to do better. You have to be confident enough that in one of those two things to say that it's not your fault and I'm going to continue to do this, or I'm going to get better at this, and the only way to get better at this is go back out there and do it. So it takes a little bit of ego. So when you're in amongst the people who all have some somewhere on the spectrum of ego, you know, they're whether they're experienced or not, they have some kind of level of confidence in themselves and their own abilities and their own thought processes. So anybody who's going against them, who's hitting them with it, is going to be defensive about it. You know, especially when you're talking about the excitement just to perform. You're like, oh, here's an opportunity for me to perform. So when you add in eager to perform, ego, naivety, and put in all these things, you're going to immediately look at anybody saying, don't do this because of X, Y, and Z as being a threat. And I understand that. Yep. I get that. I guess I don't understand it, but
they're
wrong.
It. Like,
It's like, hey, listen to someone a little more experienced. I know you're excited to do this, but you're like, it's so hard to try. People are easily exploited. It's so hard to convince them that they're not being exploited. It's almost akin to like trying to talk somebody out of being in an abusive relationship. Like there's so many parallels for someone who is like, hey, maybe you should stop dating a dude that hits you, is very similar to, hey, maybe you should stop doing bringer shows. Like, it's a lot of the same conversations.
Oh man, yeah. And even just like someone probably at your, you know, almost like an intervention too, is like someone who's an addict or something, you know, something just like, hey, you need to be aware of this thing. And I try to strip the ego part because it's hard, and I'm not always successful at it, but like in having those communications, because it's not about anybody's, like, you know, them, anybody feeling or being the right. It doesn't matter who's right. It's just like, how do we help each other? And that's kind of what I've tried to form, which is difficult with a bunch of people who are never going to go on stage in real life. And many who are, and just kind of everything in between has been kind of bananas.
So let's go to the beginning of, now that we've told everybody that Displaced Comedians Facebook group
is like,
a toxic place
thing?
Of ego is the literal pathway to hell of good intentions. Because I can empathize a lot with you with creating that space, because I, up until 2018, when I moved here to Boston, there was a Facebook community that was very toxic, and somebody had put in the Facebook group of Boston comedians, put in a question as like, what do you guys think the scene needs and how can we improve it? And I sat and I started writing this really long comment about how we don't do any promotion or shows. That shows keep, like when I moved here, I used to hear about shows getting canceled all the time because no audience would show up. Or there's certain shows where an audience member did show up that you were so insular in your, like, you know, group of, we only want to be our boys club, you would basically make them so uncomfortable they'd leave. And you're not utilizing these tools and online resources and this and that about promoting. And I'm writing this big long comment and I went, select all, delete. And that's when I created, I went to Reddit. There was a Boston comedy Reddit page that was inactive. I messaged the person running and said, hey, make me the administrator. I want to take this over. And I created a whole outlet of promotion aimed at comedy fans, not comedians.
Audience.
I wanted audience to show up the thing. That's what I get, what I created. So it started as a Reddit, became a Facebook page and a Twitter page as well. and became a website and a calendar site. And what I did is every day, 30 plus hours a week, I list, you know, I wrote up on the site and created Facebook, Twitter posts promoting the every show that was coming in the Boston area that day. On like New Year's Eve, I would write a big, huge, long page about all the New Year's comedy shows.
Wow.
You know, and all that stuff. And I would work diligently on creating this promotional outlet that worked, you know, for the most part. But I also had to fight against comedians who were like, for whatever reason, comedians who were saying like, oh, I'm doing this for money. What money? I pay for the website myself. I don't charge anyone advertising. I don't even have ads on my own website yet because I can't get to it to the point to monetize it yet. I mean,
yeah,
there was plans to monetize this thing so I can make it a job. I just never got that far. People offered me money for promotion and I turned it down because I want like the Wilbur Theater, which if you is like, if you listen to enough comedians, they all talk about the Wilbur Theater because it's usually the first theater most comedians do that they could sell out. So that's here in Boston. They reached out and contacted me personally and say, hey, can we pay you to prioritize our promotion? And I went, no. I want everyone to have the same equal amount of promotion. That's why I did this because
we have similar shit on this. This is super fascinating, by the way. I love learning about this.
Yeah. And I what I told them was like, occasionally give me free tickets to give away as promotion. That way I'm adding value to the scene because if you're following,
you're not
me
even
to
asking
win
for free
tickets,
shit for yourself.
You're going to follow. Well, yeah. I didn't want the tickets for me. I wanted to give them away to people because I can do a Twitter contest, give away free tickets. And if you're following my Twitter account because you're going to win tickets from the Wilbur, there is a chance you're going to see information about another show and you're going to go to it. Like,
tell your friends about it and share that. And
yeah. And then I end up giving up because I just had to fight with so many comedians like, oh, you're just doing this. You're holding this over other people's head to get bookings. I'm like, I've never told anyone. Show me one conversation where I had with somebody where I was like, you should book me or I won't promote your show, or you should book me because I promote your show. Show me one conversation where that happened. And just after so much negativity, like so many people would just refuse to I would message people like, hey, who's going to be on your show this week? I want to tag all the comedians in it. And they would just not reply. And it's like, after all that, I just gave it up. And I gave it up right when I lost my job, which is when I should have doubled down on it. And then tried to make it and try to monetize it. But instead I was like, I give up. This comedy scene doesn't deserve this level of work. And just like I had a list of all open mics that were in the New England area that I personally kept track of my own self. Unlike Bad Slava, where you're like, if a mic dies, you have to tell them. Like, no, I was every month reached out to people. Like, hey, is your open mic still going? Okay, cool. Thanks. Every couple of months, I reach out to people, make sure that the information was up to date. And other comedians refused to give that information to traveling comedians who were coming to town. I would talk to comedians like, oh, is this your site? Yeah, people told me that you're an asshole, this and that, but you're fine. And this is a great resource. And I don't understand why. And it's just jealousy or I'm not, you know, just was
no
unlike from the beginning, whatever.
I respect the fact that you called it, honestly, that you were like, you know what? Done.
Yeah. Well, like, it's also you're having to deal with that too. Similar thing where it's like, oh, high and mighty Nico picking and choosing what to, censoring comedians. It's like, no, you're just an asshole who used the N-word and we got rid of your post or whatever it is. I just made that up out of the clear blue. That is not anything that happened. I was just creating a fictitious example.
But
why.
Things like that. Yeah. I always know I made the right call when I get angry DMs. Then I'm like, oh, I should have kicked you out sooner. I was just being real. Now, like I try to make that as a last thing, you know, removing somebody from a group, I feel like it's kind of a big deal to do. And it's gotta be based on something real, not just, you know, seventh hand information about nothing. It gets bananas. That's interesting. I didn't know that you had done that. So kudos to having done that. And also realizing, hey, maybe it wasn't worth, you know, figure out when your energy doesn't need to be utilized. That was.
Yeah, I mean, I have to try and, like, I've done so many things that don't bring me joy that I feel like I need to do. And I was like, this is me paying dues, or this is just the way of life of it. I'm getting older and older. It's like, I can't do the things that don't bring me joy anymore. Like, my trivia nights. Out of the three trivia nights I was hosting, I gave up one of them because, one, I was overworked and burnt out. And two, I was like, this one doesn't bring me joy. it's becoming a dread. It's not as successful as I want it to be. I don't get along with the staff at the place as much as I do my other places. And I could use the money, but I am going to give it up. And that's why I fight so many. Like, I'm not involved in the Boston Comedians Facebook group, 'cause I'm like, this doesn't bring me joy. You know, fighting with people online doesn't bring me joy. Some people love fighting online. Tom Myers loves to fight online. And you're like, more power to you, Tommy boy. Good. All right. That's fine by me if that's what you want to do, but I have no interest in that anymore. And I can't imagine you, somebody who's a positive influence that, you know, is, let's say you have a happy-go-lucky attitude. You're plucky, you know, like that I think that describes your general demeanor as just being a positive person. I can't imagine the dread you have to go through every time a Facebook comments section gets out of control. And you're like, okay.
It's like, how do I push on this? Yeah. Luckily I feel like it's been less of that in the last year or so, but,
I feel like
very stressful times.
How do you feel about the people that just join the group that have no interest in actual what the group was, which was a resource for comedians to do online shows, and just people who are like, oh, I'm a comedian, I have to join this group? What's your opinion on those people?
That's interesting. I'm glad you asked this. This is interesting, and you might have different views, and a lot of people do, and that's fine. I got a realization that it's just, I'm going to run how I'm going to do it, I love it. I think it's the evolution of it. So when someone posted the other day, like Dante Barnett posted the other day, like, hey, I love this when it was just, you know, seven people. No, they didn't say exactly that, but you know what I mean?
Like, I saw the post.
When it was, and it was dope.
It was just a community of Zoomers.
Me and you and a half other people, and we're like, hey, let's just talk and tell jokes. And it partially was like, comedy is a big part of it, but also we're just people trying to connect and hang out. So then let's just hang out afterwards and let's just talk about whatever's going on. And we're just shooting the shit. And that was some of the best moments. And in live comedy, as we know, that some of those best moments are the after hang and going out after and getting dinner at 2 a.m. or whatever the hell. Like those, that's the magic right there on top of the performing and whatever.
Yeah, during the pandemic, which we knew on most Zooms is just to each other anyway. Was the hang, show hang was...
It was the best.
That's just chilling and bullshit.
And I had just gotten a taste of it. Which is weird too, because I was also like, I only want to do comedy when I travel for work. At home, it's home time for my family. But how do I get comedy out there? And how do I help? I want to perform and have my friends who aren't in these other cities see it. So I was thinking of like Twitch and these different things. And then just all this shit happened. But so you're asking about what I think about people just joining. I think it's great. My view, it's the right group to join if you are a comedian, an aspiring comedian, just like someone in the stage of like, oh, I'm thinking up some stories and I want to go do jokes, or even just a really big fan of comedy. And I'm fine with some of that. And some of the people in the group are personal friends of mine, like people in the group that aren't comedians. A lot of them are just friends of mine that I'm like, I want them to see what's going on. And sometimes they'll comment and I'm like, oh, fuck, I know you, I love you, but... I almost want to like tag that person. People know, they're not a comedian. They don't get there. It's okay. Like, here's a little badge. Like, they're great. I'm happy they're here.
Visitor comment badge.
they're wonderful people. I love them. And they're in the right, their heart's in the right place, but their perspective on this is going to be a little different than yours because they're not doing this, but I still want them to go watch your Zoom show and watch my live or your live shows too, whatever. I think it's great. I like that. And yes, I do miss, just like anything, like when we were just a crew of people that were just doing that, that was cool. But now it's so much bigger because I feel like I knew that at some point that was going to happen. And then now it's going to translate to live where I can go, you can go. Anybody who's actually been a part of it and really kind of gets it, and even really new people in it, can go and go pretty much anywhere and find someone who can connect them to someone, to connect them to someone to do a show and do a comedy. Like, and that to me is freaking awesome. And it's just going to become more of that. And people shit on me sometimes for like letting so many live things get, I'm like, dude, the world changes. Yes. This is how we started. It was Zoom. I started it because I wanted us waiting for us to connect, but eventually we knew someday it was going to be, you know, live comedy is going to happen again. So I try to just make it so that it's still helpful for doing live stuff too, regardless of where you're physically located. So you're going to see people post about shows somewhere that you're never going to be, but someone's looking at that post and might use that as a lead of a show they can maybe get on and or go see that show. So,
see, that's where balance. You and me differ, and it's your page, and it's your group. You get to do what you want.
Yep.
But this is where, like, the amount of times I've had to delete a comment that I was going to post of, why don't you go to one of the other 1,000 other comedian groups that have answered this question? Like, this is for this. And that's because I happen to be very, myopic on certain things. You know, and like, I'm also a purist. I'm also like, if somebody wanted to talk about their live band in the Displaced Comedians, I would flip my lip like, that's not what this place is for. Like,
that's
it's
so
for
funny.
Comedians doing Zoom. Like, that's because that just happens to be the way my brain works. Thank God I'm not in charge of it. However, the weird thing is, like, when I hear somebody go to Displaced Comedians talk about, hey, do you guys think this would be a good first bit to do on my first open mic? I'm like, get out of here. But at the same time, when somebody would come to my Reddit, even still, I occasionally keep an eye on the Reddit where somebody be like, hey, I'm thinking about doing comedy. Where's a good place to do an open mic? I'm bend over backwards to tell them where good open mics are. Because in my mind, that is the forum for that. Whereas this place comedian, it's like, where's a good place to go to open mic in Minnesota? It's like, that's not what this place is for. Go find Minnesota Facebook comedy group. You know, like,
and that's fair.
In my damaged, broken brain.
So I get that. I get that perspective. I have different views than you on this.
You do, and I see your view, and I also agree with you at the same time. That's why it's very tormenting for me. It's like, he's just being helpful. He wants to be nice. Like, that is just let Nico be nice.
So that's funny. I should write, let's let Nico be nice. Should be a fucking thing on that. So here's the thing, though. There's going to be so there is all the regional groups, and I highly encourage everybody to join the regional groups. And that's how this started, is because I had traveled and joined these groups, and I saw this person's doing a Zoom. This person's doing a Zoom. Someone's got to we got to be connected and get in one spot so we know what's happening. Because if we got a few people from all these different scenes, now we're a scene ourselves as the Zoom community, as you've seen that develop as being a scene. But there's still, obviously the different locations. So that person asking about where to do an open mic in Minnesota or whatever the hell, I'm hoping that somebody there comments the group to go to for that. And possibly some stuff that they're doing there too. So is some of that going to be a little redundant? Sure, but I don't mind them posting that there, because there's also we're also everywhere. So like, I've seen people comment, it's been really cool. And one of the things I love is when I see someone ask that, and then someone that I didn't know, or like I hadn't seen on a Zoom, or maybe like I had seen them comment somewhere, and maybe I'd never seen them comment at all, but I'll click later and realize I've been in the group for 2 years, and they'll be like, hey, this is the place to go to. I like this place. Also, here's a group you can join for that. So you're getting more connected, and I still want all those regional groups to be what they are, but still having a centralized place where people can join and share information and help each other, I think it's important too.
Yeah, if I had to spend my pandemic just doing only Boston Zoom comedy, I wouldn't have survived the pandemic. Like, Zoom comedy literally kept me from going insane. Like, I tried to sell so many people on it. It's like, look, yeah, okay, it's not the same. Whatever, you're telling jokes for people to laugh at. How is it different than being on stage? Okay. Also, at the same time, I'm willing to admit, it's methadone for a performance addiction. Like, it's not it's not the real stuff, but it'll get you through. No. And Boston basically shut down. Like, how many comedians from New England did you meet during the pandemic? Not very many. Because they refused to do it.
Yeah.
And the few things that were happening here were just sad. Like, they had no interest of like expanding against the away from they didn't want to promote it to other people. They really was just like, it was just like therapy hangs and sad open mics. And it's like the few that were trying to actually tell jokes were just sad. And they didn't have any idea of like, well, let's put on a show and get people like, it was just Boston comedy during the pandemic was so depressing. And there were some people who were trying and some people who were, trying to do good things. But for the most part, it's just everyone kind of just sadly gave up. And I'm like, I'm not going to sit here and just have every week sit with you guys and just have a funeral to comedy on Zoom. I'm going to go out and tell actual jokes and have performances and try to make audiences laugh again. And if it wasn't for groups like, I don't know which one I joined first, if it was Pandemic or Displaced or whatever it was. I think the first was Flappers, because Flappers was already hitting me up about that. Like, Flappers was supposed to do a satellite audition show for the Burbank Comedy Festival here in Boston at the club I worked at.
Okay.
And I had, outside of the club I worked at, got accepted into that audition. And of course it was March 30th. It got canceled by the pandemic. So they were already like, hey, sending out group emails of, hey, we have these Zoom open mics. We have these Zoom shows, blah, 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 blah. And so from day one of them doing that, that's how I was already involved with it. And I know I was quickly involved with Rachel's Panda Mic because I was like, oh, cool. This, you know, I found this. This is something to do. And then, you know, the rest is.
That's interesting. History. You're already connected with them a bit with that because so Rachel Rothenberg, her that was the first Zoom I did. I had seen a comedian who I had met in Tacoma, Washington, which is somewhere I traveled quite a bit for work. And that's where I did a lot of the stand-up that I've done to that point. And Carol Freeman's a comedian who was there, is now lives in Arizona. But I saw that she was doing a Zoom on Rachel's thing. So I was like, all right, I just want to watch and just see how this is. And I watched and I'm like, all right, I got to figure out an angle. Before I did the virtual background thing and bounced back and forth about caring about that, I was like, what angle in my garage could I actually show? You know, and still, and do this set. And then I was like, this is a thing I'm going to do. And then shortly after do my first set on there, which, you know, I feel like went fine, but it isn't life. Like anyone's saying it's the same thing. No one's saying that. It's just, but it's still not nothing.
Yeah.
You know? And then I got like, all right, now I need to organize this. And like, someone's got to organize. I was actually talking to Rachel about it. And later I talked about it. I'm like, hey, like, is it weird that I now run this? Because her and I had communicated about like one of us was going to start a group to try to do the thing that I was talking about, like connect everybody. And she just did it. And I did. And later she's like, I'm glad that I didn't.
Yeah. I can't see Rachel doing it now. Like she would start Wednesday and Adams her way out of it.
Fantastic and funny and great. And I'm glad that she had her group also, because that fostered a little bit of a different environment too, because she did have her group that she ran for a long time. And I just wanted to, organize it and just have a place to do it. And eventually it was like, oh, this one main Facebook post is really long. I got to just make it a Google sheet that people could just go to. And then I would just like interrogated people, the information I thought was important or that I knew that I still know to be important. How long are sets? You obviously knowing things can change. How long are sets? Are you streaming this? Because that's also a weird thing. You used to go to an open mic at some bar. You're not broadcasting this to whoever. Now, are people watching this? I don't know. But could somebody look this video up and see you make this stupid dick joke? Probably. And do you want that? I don't know. I know some people that wouldn't do them if they were streamed. And then I definitely acted different depending, you know, you'd act differently depending on the situation you're in, and then putting like who up people and where they're located. Cause like funny that you mentioned that, like in your scene, cause there were some scenes, as you know, that were more active. Like there's a lot of people in California that did a lot of stuff like around like San Medina, Athena Rodriguez and, group. And then, you know, and then we had some people out of New York that ended up getting pretty into it. And like, there were some ones out of Portland, Oregon, that there was a group of people that would only, for the most part, only do those. So like if you were in the other Zooms, you just didn't even know that scene, but that was cool because then if you're in the other Zooms and you found theirs, now you got more people to connect to, not just to do shows and stuff, but like just to talk to. And even though we know most of the people on here are comics and not just audience, that's still new audience that, you know, there's other comedians that haven't heard your jokes before in these different scenes.
And that was the interesting thing. Like I was just in Toronto the other week for a festival called Far From Here Festival. And the premise to this festival was, all these comedians met and performed on Zoom. Now they'll be together for the first time in real life. It's the gimmick. Some of us had met in real life.
I think it's cool.
It was a cool thing. I loved the concept, loved the idea. Yeah. That's why I applied for it. That's why I got into it as an alternate, which they didn't have to tell me I was an alternate. All right. They sent me an email going, hey, you were not accepted, but you're on the list of alternates in case someone drops out. I was like, all right, never going to hear from them again. And then I get an email 1 month before the festival. They're like, hey, somebody dropped out. You still want to do it? I'm like, you didn't have to tell me somebody dropped out. You could have just said, hey, Dennis, we want you for the festival.
We made space. You were so good. We're like, we need Dennis in this.
You could have just told me that it was that I was in the festival. You didn't have to. Anyway, which, by the way, gave me 1 month to get a passport together, which.
Oh, geez.
You want to know exactly what time I got my passport?
What?
3 p.m. the day before my 8 a.m. flight.
Oh my gosh. Right? Is that when you received it? You have to get it? Like, you got to pay extra to get, like, the fast whatever? Oh.
Yeah, it was it was an ordeal. Like, I got it the day before my flight. And trust me, if your story about your first open mic made you nervous, me telling you that I got my passport, what's that, 17 hours before leaving the country, that's what I'm going to pretty, someone who travels like you, that's going to make
you nervous.
You can't
cancel that flight in any plan. So did you get to meet some of the people you
Zoomed
with?
Yeah, I did.
I remember some of the posts about it.
This is one of the big, this festival is the one where I knew the most amount of people.
I love this so much.
This is
the magical treat we get.
Right? Like, North Carolina was a festival where I knew people, but there were so many people in it that it was impossible for me to know the amount of people in it a large amount. And I made a lot of friends from it. Some of them were, you know, I've seen it other things since then. But this one was like, so it's nice. I've done so many festivals where I don't know anybody. So I'm going alone to a city for 3 or 4 days and I have to figure out getting around. I have to go out and make friends, and then organize events to try and, like, hey, I'm going to go to this thing tomorrow. Does anyone else want to come along? You know, so we can do group activities and stuff, and I can hang out and get to know people. I didn't have to do really any of that in this one. Things were already planned. I just had to, like, can I tag along? Or, you know, like, we were already friends. We were all like, all right, so what are we all going to do tomorrow, gang? Which was nice. It was nice to, like, be in a different city and get to experience the city with friends.
Dude, just hearing this, I'm just getting so happy. This makes me so happy.
Yeah, and, like, I got to meet Kelly Zemnikis. I got to prove that Kelly and Desiree both, in fact, do have legs. Like, it was nice to see both of them. And I think if you know Desiree, that's probably a mean comment, but no, she has them.
Yep,
and
she has them.
Yes. I get to see what her wheels look like. All right. Anyway,
that's so cool, man. That makes me so happy.
Yeah, and
that's
like, you gotta have some similar experience to that with the amount that you travel. That when you go back to a city you've been at, you've now been doing it long enough to where you're making friends. Well, dude, even when you started going back out, you were doing the, like, I finally get to meet Zoom, insert Zoom friend here in person.
Yeah. Dude, it was so, like, it's interesting because I've had different versions. I've had the version of where I've met somebody who, like, I didn't even know at all, which is crazy. They just happened to be in the group, and I never, like, communicated with them, but they were like, hey, they enjoyed the group and they made friends in it, but also just like, you know, hi, this is a neat way to connect. I'm like, oh my gosh, thanks, you know, thanks for being in, and appreciate their appreciation of just being a part of it. And then seeing people that that I did know, and like, I've had people that have, like, come to town, like Danny DeLuca, Jackie Pearl, Gretchen came out. I would mess up her last name if I said, you know, we're doing some shows in Boise, and then I went and I swung by their Airbnb and brought my 5-year-old daughter and said hi to them and stuff, who they might have seen on Zoom. I'm not sure if they had or not, but it was just really cool. And actually, Danny, you know, got me a guest spot on a show when I did a trade show. I was at a trade show in Sacramento, earlier this year. And she helped me, you know, get a spot on a show that I got to do with her, and then run into, Henry. Why am I brain farting on his last name? Henry does the midnight movies thing or whatever, but it's another, you know, that person I had Zoomed with a bunch, who's really fun. And
the person who's going to leave a comment on this going, how could Nico possibly forget my name?
I don't think Cruz is the right last name, because there's a different Henry Cruz. But then I was at one in Tacoma where a guy who I'd never seen comment or had remembered that, but he was like, dude, that group, like, saved my life, and now I'm doing all these live things, and I didn't do comedy before. And he had just done like a great set at this, like, kind of more like a divey bar kind of regular open mic kind of place, but I just had no idea. But just after the mic, he came up and said hi, and I was like, holy shit, that's awesome. Because I don't know, just people that I didn't even know were there. It's been really cool. So I've been very fortunate to be able to experience kind of that whole range of things, and getting to connect with people. And it's been pretty fun. And I think it's going to keep being fun.
Yeah, it's nice making friends in other cities. when you do comedy. Like, it's because it's a shorthand we already have. It's a thing that we already have in common with each other. So it makes being friends a little bit easier. And even if they're not somebody you see all the time, you can literally just be like, you already have something in common. So it's like, you already have something to talk about. You always have something to relate to. You always have something to commiserate to. And it's, you know, it's almost like, you know, having, you know, like you just pick up where you left off. It's almost like having a very old friend that you've not really known that long.
Yeah. That's a good way. That's a good way to word that. And like everything, we just want to be connected to each other. And now we are. And I feel like the treat of the people that have been doing this for a while are like that experience you had, you know, getting to see Kelly and Desiree and other people who you've certainly connected with in this weird, bizarre time. And now you get to do stuff in person with. And that always excites me to see pictures of people doing that.
You know who I saw by surprise? Ashwin Singh.
Was Oh, awesome.
Yeah, I went, like, me and a comedian from West Virginia were the only two at, like, late night. We're like, let's go out and do something, gang. They're like, we're tired. So we go to this late night open mic, and I'm sitting, you know, we both go up and we do whatever. Of course, the host, here's a couple people from America. I'm like, shut up. And then I got, like, white guy from Boston up next. I'm like, I live in Boston. I'm not from there. Please don't tell people that. I hate that city. And we're sitting there, we do our sets, and I just hear, all right, come up next, it's so-and-so, Ashwin Singh. And I went, Ashwin! Oh, and he's like, Dennis, why are you here?
Oh,
why are you
so
here?
Cool.
Oh, you live here. Like, that was the, I mean, you know, Ashwin and I, we have our animosity slash friendship slash whatever.
We're strong personalities.
Yeah, we're both strong personalities, and we both acknowledge and know that. And we get along when we have to. And we have, you know, commonalities that we like, but also we both hate each other at the same time. Like, we're the bestest of frenemies. But in that moment, we're both excited to see each other.
And I feel like some of those things drop away when you're a person. I think a lot of those things are just like, who gives a fuck? Let's just hug. Who cares about any of that shit?
Which he did.
Well, and by whatever, the way, dude. We're humans.
The amount of people I elbow bump, like, oh, I don't shake hands, elbows. Like, okay, here, elbow. Yeah. Okay, all right, I'll do the distant one-armed hug, and I'll turn my face away so neither of us breathe each other's airs, that I still do. Not with Ashwin. I saw him. I literally just bear hugged him, and I'm like, Ashwin!
That's what you do. Yeah. That's awesome, man. I'm glad you had that.
I may have also been drinking, so.
Yeah.
All right, so some the final pushing. Thing is, a man like you who travels as much as you do, what are Nico Lukoff's travel hacks? Because I want to say, this week, I'll give you a couple seconds to think about them, because this week alone,
I know
the amount, like, I just learned, or canceled flights. Oh, have I been looking into canceled flights and like booking booking upgrades and like giving up your seats and stuff? Because I saw a Twitter thread the other day of, apparently at JFK on Christmas, one of the gate people were like, all right, anyone willing to give up their seat will get a $400 credit and blah, blah, this and that. And then just somebody was sat there and went, more. And they're like, all right, 600. And they became this weird bidding until some old lady walked away with $1,100 and some other stuff. Ooh. And I'm like, you can do that? Because when I've never been asked for the give up on all the times I fly until Toronto. I was getting emails and they're like, hey, we'll give you $300 credit if you give up your seat and delay your flight. And I was like, oh, there's only 210 round trips, so I'm making $90 credit. This will pay for my LA trip in 2023 that I'm planning. I should do it. And I didn't do it. But I didn't realize that I could also just argue my way up I didn't realize I could go up to the gate agent and be like, all right, for $1,500, a hotel stay and a food voucher and a reflight upgraded to first class, I'll give up my seat. I did not know I could do that. I didn't know I could negotiate that way. Did you? Like, did you know that?
So I'll be honest with you. That's a scale of travel hack that I was not going, that I was not sharing. I'm not that exciting. Oh, that sounds awesome. I have had one time though, if anyone offers you a food voucher, verify the value of that first. Because I've had a flight where they were like, you're going to go the next day and, you know, stay at a hotel. And I'm like, okay, I'll get some credit or whatever. But then like, here's a food voucher. And it was like $7. I'm like, you can't get anything.
Oh, you can,
like,
buy this is insane. You can buy you can buy half a Starbucks drink at the airport for $7.
Right. And that was bullshit. That was years ago. But the stuff I liked, so a couple things, this is going to sound weird. I don't care. Toilet paper. Nobody cares about your comfort other than you. Nobody, no hotel cares about how. So I'll generally travel with quality toilet paper. I will bring my own toilet paper. Generally Charmin, something like a roll a day. Not because I need a roll a day, but sometimes I'm going to towns or I'm going to a hotel each night and then I might forget a roll on there right when I get in. That's the first thing I do when I get in the room is I switch out that toilet paper roll.
Really? Because I'm a crap. I use the at home by Scott. I buy the cheap toilet paper, but yeah. I use the man or not man, but I use the wipes. That's my thing.
Oh, the like baby wipes.
Yep.
Kind of thing. Yep. And then I'll bring those with me too. Just a lot of times just because like I'll be driving and I'll end up being like, you know, eating some food or something in the car. And then the other thing I like to do, which now doesn't sound nearly as impressive, but at the time when my wife told me about this, I got really excited, was the curtains. So before I go out to do whatever show or mic, whatever that night, close the curtains and use the clip. Cause there was always that little crack that brightens up the room. If it's not like the ones that go up and down, it's the ones that just go to connect. So using, one of the hangers that has the clips in the closet and using that to clip that shut. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. So between that and toilet paper, I'm like, I'm set. I can get through anything.
Brad Sherwood, who is from Whose Line Is It Anyway? When I interviewed him and asked him for travel hacks, that was his hack. So you're in good company with that one's like, sleep so much during the day and the sun cracks in, either bring duct tape or use the hotel pant hangers to close your blinds and get total darkness.
Nice. Nice. And then when you're flying a lot too, the lounge, I mean, that's if you're flying like a Alaska lounge, I think it was like $400. So it's not free, but, unlimited well drinks, food and just somewhere to just chill at a hotel, chill at an airport and like go to the bath, like set your bags down and go to the bathroom and feel like a person and have your own little space. If you travel enough, getting those, lounge passes. Freaking amazing, especially when you get like a bunch of delays and shit and you're just like, well, I'm just going to sit here and drink and eat until my plane goes and not spend tons of money in the airport.
Yeah, see, I've never been in the lounge, but you bring up that good point where you can just leave your bag and go to the bathroom and be confident because the amount of times that I'm like, the amount of times I have to just carry my carry-on into the bathroom, sling it over my shoulder, make sure I don't pee on it and get it out of the way. It's like, this is so much easier. I just asked the person, I was like, can you just keep an eye on my bag? I know no one's going to steal it because if they're going to steal the bag, where are they going to go with it? They're stuck in the airport. But even if they do.
Don't mind the ticking sound. Just I want you to watch
that's,
it.
Yeah, that's the big concern is like, here, you'll watch this bag. Ah, la, 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 la. Like, that's what I feel like every time I ask somebody to watch my bag for me. Or if I get up from my seat away from my bag to go throw something away, I'm fearful I'm going to get tackled by airport security. It's like, unattended bag. The lounge thing if I flew enough, I could see the value in that where it's like between the food and the drinks over a year. Yeah, that's definitely, you bring up a good point.
And you've already mentioned the Bratislava thing. And that's what I started with when I started doing comedy was like, where do I go? And that's the site that I found that I would join the regional groups. And now I just find the regional groups. They usually have a good place and reach out to try to book as many shows as I can when I'm going somewhere. Which has been pretty fun and, been working out pretty good.
Good. All right. Well, Nico, this has been a good, fun conversation. It was good catching up because now that like we've all gone back to our real lives, none of us see each other online anymore.
Yeah,
so we don't know. So great, it's like nice to see and chat and remember that, you know, why we're doing this and why we're friends and how we became friends and why we enjoy doing these things. So this was good. And it was nice to hear where you started because I didn't know that you got into this industry because of a hobby, which the literal reason I'm doing everything I do is because I started out in community theater. I started out wanting to, you know, take the things that I was doing for fun and do them as a career. And you did that same thing too, but your, you know, fun things was, you know, making booze and you turn making booze into a career, which is lovely to hear. So thank you so much for being on the show today.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me on, man. I'm excited that it worked out. And like you said, it's great to connect and hang out again and catch up.
company.